Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
The Appeal of Isis. Malise Riven. How are we to account for the extraordinary success of Isis, also known as Daesh from its Arabic initials, in recruiting young Muslims, including many from European immigrant families, to its ranks? An error made by numerous commentators, including the former Mayor of London and Conservative MP Boris Johnson, is that people who join ISIS are losers, individuals who are drawn to terrorism because they cannot make it, sexually or professionally, in the countries such as Britain where they reside. While there may be some individuals who conform to this model, it is only part of the picture. As some of the better informed journalists and academics have explained, many ISIS operatives are highly accomplished individuals who could have made successful careers in their countries of origin had they so chosen. Dismissing ISIS as a terrorist organization is also problematic. Terrorists are usually freelance guerrillas who do not seek to hold territory, as ISIS does. Terrorism, as Richard English points out in Terrorism, How to Respond, 2009, has numerous definitions, but most conform to a Clausewitzian calculus. If our opponent is to be made to comply with our will, we must place him in a situation which is more oppressive to him than the sacrifice which we demand. What Clausewitz calls the breaking of an enemy's will through exploitation of fear could be applied to wartime campaigns of state belligerence, including the strategic bombing of German cities such as Hamburg and Dresden by the Allies during the Second World War, as well as to the partisans, designated as terrorists by the Nazis, who resisted German or fascist rule in France and Italy in the 1940s. Violence is inherent in the modern nation-state. Most of the violence we witness in contemporary arenas, such as the shock and awe tactics favoured in Iraq by former US Secretary of State Colin Powell, is executed by state authorities in line with Max Weber's definition of the state as a legally recognized entity having a monopoly of violence. Here, of course, a crucial question of legitimacy arises. There are two principal definitions of statehood. Declaratory statehood, which is independent of recognition by other states, and constitutive statehood, requiring recognition by other states. While we may deplore its methods, ISIS meets the criteria of the first, if not the second, since no state has yet come to recognize it. However, like most other states, it can plausibly claim to have a monopoly of power in the territory it holds. Unlike other Muslim political entities, however, it also claims the supranational moral legitimacy of the caliphate. This is easily dismissed, and indeed has been by most of the acknowledged institutions in the majority Sunni tradition. The question this raises is, how far does formal rejection or non-acknowledgement by religious authorities and formal institutions dent its appeal for the majority? There can be no doubt that most Islamic institutions, whether Sunni or Shia, including ultra-conservative Salafis, have denied legitimacy to ISIS and condemned it as un-Islamic. A powerful condemnation has been made by the Secretary General of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, who stated that its crimes against Christians and other minorities have nothing to do with Islam. the principles of which, rather, call for justice, kindness, fairness, freedom of faith, and coexistence. The Grand Mufti of Al-Azhar, Egypt's highest religious authority, denounced it as a threat to Islam that violated both Sharia and humanitarian law. Muslim organizations in Europe and North America have been virtually unanimous in condemning ISIS on moral and theological grounds, while Saudi Arabia's highest religious authority, the Grand Mufti Abdulaziz Al-Sheikh, has stated that terrorism is anti-Islamic and that groups such as ISIS that practice violence are the number one enemy of Islam. In September 2014, more than 120 Islamic scholars, including Sunnis, Shias, and ultra-Orthodox Salafis, co-signed an 18-page open letter to ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, written in Arabic, containing a point-by-point criticism of the organization's actions and ideology, based on the Quran and other classical religious texts. A question that arises is, how much traction can such statements have with would-be jihadists wanting to sign up with groups such as ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, which are seen as defending Islamic communities and the idea of Islam from the onslaught of barrel bombs by the infidel Assad regime in Syria or by Shia militias in Iraq, seen as being supported by the Iranian government? While some experts on modern Islam, such as Princeton University's Bernard Haykel, have argued that leaders of ISIS have as much legitimacy as other Islamic authorities, this is seriously disputed by others, including the influential British convert Timothy Winter, a lecturer at Cambridge University, who also writes under the assumed Muslim name of Abdul Hakim Murad. Legitimacy comes through the endorsement of religious leaders, says Winter, who sees the religious world as being packed with fringe and fundamentalist groups that claim the mantle of total authenticity. To accept such assertions at face value is either naive or tendentious. Just as Christianity in Bosnia cannot be reduced to the church-going militias of Radovan Karadzic, or Judaism to the activities of West Bank settlers who burn down mosques or murder Arab babies, Islam is not represented by ISIS. Representation, however, is a problematic term in the context of religious conflicts, or conflicts in which participants may be motivated by religious feelings, or feelings of solidarity with their co-religionists, regardless of approval by religious authorities. Irish Republicans, including, it is thought, Eamon de Valera, were never deterred from armed struggle against their British or Irish opponents by the threat of being excommunicated during the Civil War that tore the country apart in the 1920s. In the case of a highly organized system such as the Roman Catholic Church, with its centrally approved teachings and top-down hierarchy of cardinals, bishops, and priests, there may be clear boundaries between activities that have religious backing and those that do not. At least Irish Republicans, most of whom were raised as Catholics, knew where they stood vis-à-vis the formal teachings of their faith when their commitment to the cause for which they were fighting brought them into conflict with the Church. In the discursive and polemicized realm of Islamic theology, the issue is far more ambiguous, since religious hierarchies and the moral boundaries they police are much less salient. The pronouncement of takfir, stating that one's opponents are unbelievers, has become a standard trope in polemics between jihadists and their enemies, with insurgents often accused of being takfiris, that is to say, groups who see their opponents as being outside the pale of correct Islamic faith and practice. The fact that the Orthodox mainstream takes the view that takfiris render themselves heretical by excommunicating their fellow Muslims in the manner of the ultra-puritanical Khawarij, also known as Kharijites, adds to the difficulty. The 7th century Khawarij departed from the majority view by declaring grave sinners to be infidels. It is difficult, not to say impossible, to accuse Takfiris such as the ISIS militants of being Khawarij without opening oneself to the very same accusation, a contradiction displayed by the eminent Saudi apologist Prince Turki Al-Faisal, a former Saudi ambassador to Washington and director of intelligence, in his widely distributed tract attacking ISIS. The idea that legitimacy comes through the endorsement of religious leaders carries little weight when its opposite, delegitimization, via accusations of infidelity and kharijism, carries no obvious sanction, such as refusal of the sacraments. When words like takfir and khawarij are routinely used in religious polemic, the currency of anathema loses its value. The authenticity or legitimacy of the caliphate raises similar difficulties. While the authority of a pope is, with rare exceptions, uncontested inside the institution he heads, and is generally acknowledged, if opposed, by his historic rivals or enemies, be they Orthodox, Protestant, secular, or even non-Christian, the caliph is an uncertain and evanescent figurehead whose authority, whether spiritual or secular, has suffered a lengthy decline. Except at the very beginnings of Islam and for a brief period in the High Middle Ages, the caliphate has not been a functioning institution. As Prince Turki himself explains, "The meaning of the term caliph is somewhat elusive, as the position has a long history. The first caliph, with the consensus of his people, led the entire Muslim community in the wake of the Prophet's death and provided spiritual as well as political guidance. Centuries later, as the Islamic world grew, splintered, and grew even more, his successors were more like kings. In Islamic law and philosophy, the notion of a caliphate became more of an ideal than a description of reality, with various scholars debating the attributes of a true caliph, his behavior, and the type of community he would lead." The British journalist Jason Burke concurs. In his book, The New Threat from Islamic Militancy, he writes that the caliphate was, "from the beginning, an ad hoc arrangement, not a specific designed institution, which is one reason why no consensus has ever been reached on exactly what role the caliph plays." However, in former times, the caliphate did provide a significant model of Islamic governance, that while Halaq, a leading authority on Islamic law, sees as resting on moral, legal, political, social, and metaphysical foundations that are dramatically different from those sustaining the modern state. Historically, as Halaq puts it, the moral imperatives of Sharia law were affected outside the domain of the state. The political absolutism that Europe experienced, the merciless serfdom of feudalism, the abuses of the church, the inhuman realities of the Industrial Revolution, and all that which made revolutions necessary in Europe, were not, he claims, the lot of Muslims who, comparatively speaking, lived for more than a millennium in a far more egalitarian and merciful system, and, more importantly, under a rule of law that modernity cannot fairly blemish with critical detraction. In the 19th century, the Ottoman sultans exploited the transnational idea of the caliphate, reviving the institution with a view to countering the protective rights the Russian czars and Habsburg emperors claimed over Christians living under Ottoman rule. If the Tsar had rights over Christians living in the Near East and Balkans, the Sultan Caliph could claim the same rights over the Tsar's numerous Muslim subjects. The First World War and the Russian and Turkish revolutions ended any such reciprocal idea. Kemal Atatürk and the Turkish National Assembly's decision to abolish the caliphate in 1924 met little, if any, resistance in the Middle East. The caliphal idea, however, remained alive in India, where the Khilafat movement, supported by Gandhi, became a rallying point for Muslim-Hindu resistance against the British Raj. However spurious Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's claim to the caliphate might seem, It would be a mistake to underestimate its appeal for Muslims who feel themselves to be disenfranchised and humiliated. As Burke suggests, while his claim to the title of caliph may have been dismissed by all major religious authorities, and most minor ones too, none would dispute the subtext behind it. The resurrection not simply of a title, but of the power, dignity, wealth, and military renown of Muslim rulers from the 7th to the 18th century. The Muslim Brotherhood, which held power in Egypt from 2012 until its overthrow the following year, saw the restoration of the caliphate as the precondition for bringing back the Ummah, the world community of Islam, to its former glory. The Brotherhood's top official, the General Guide, saw himself as the deputy of the non-existent caliph, who in turn was supposed to represent the Prophet. Unlike the Saudi monarch, who styles himself guardian of the two holy shrines of Mecca and Medina, Baghdadi claims Qurayshite descent, a classical genealogical requirement of the caliph. Hence his claim to legitimacy appears to be stronger than that of the Al Saud, who rule Islamic Holy Land by right of conquest, with international recognition conferred by the infidel powers in 1926. It is for this reason that the Saudi regime feels particularly threatened by the challenge not just of ISIS, but of the Muslim Brotherhood, which it actively assisted in suppressing in 2013. Unlike Al-Qaeda, which organized acts of terror from remote places in the lawless regions of the Pakistan-Afghan border, ISIS appears to be a highly centralized and disciplined organization with a sophisticated security apparatus and a capacity for delegating power. The caliph, as successor of the Prophet, is the ultimate authority. But despite his sermon exhorting the believers to advise me when I err, any threat, opposition, or even contradiction is instantly eradicated. Baghdadi has two deputies, both former members of the Iraqi Ba'ath Party. Both were his fellow prisoners in Camp Booker, the sprawling American detention center in southern Iraq, now seen as the Jihadist University, where former Ba'athists and Sunni insurgents were able to form ideological and religious bonds. Abu Muslim al-Turkmani, Baghdadi's second in command, was a member of Saddam's feared military intelligence. Baghdadi's second deputy, Abu Ali al-Anbari, was a major general in the Iraqi army. While skeptics may doubt the sincerity of the ex-Ba'athists, assuming they are seeking a return to the power they enjoyed before the US invasion, it seems just as likely that their support for ISIS is motivated by religious conviction. With their former hegemony lost and the previously despised infidel Shias in the ascendant in Iraq, these erstwhile secularists may well have returned to their faith. Baghdadi and his deputies set the group's overall objectives, which are then communicated down the hierarchy with local commanders and administrators allowed to fulfill their tasks at their own discretion in territories under ISIS control. There are advisory councils and several departments run by committees, with leaders of each department sitting in Baghdadi's cabinet. Abdel Bari Atwan, a London-based Arab journalist who visited the area in late 2014, considers the number of fighters for the Islamic State considerably larger than the 100,000 or so usually cited by the Western media, a third of whom, at least 30,000, are said to be foreigners, i.e. non-Iraqis and non-Syrians. The most numerous, according to the Washington Institute, are Libyans, around 21%, followed by Tunisians and Saudis, 16%, Jordanians, 11%, Egyptians, 10%, and Lebanese, 8%. Turkish volunteers, says Atwan, have been underestimated, with some 2,000 Turks in ISIS. Europeans are led by the French brigades, composed of French and Belgians of North African descent, with some 6% of the total, followed by the British with 4.5%. He adds that Australian authorities were shocked to discover that some 200 of their nationals had joined ISIS, making the country the biggest per capita exporter of foreign jihadists. One of the primary forces driving this transformation, according to Atwan and other observers, is the digital expertise demonstrated by ISIS operatives, who have a commanding presence in social media. Like criminal gangsters, the jihadists use bitcoins and other forms of cryptocurrency, such as stored value credit cards linked to prepaid disposable mobile phones, to avoid detection when accumulating or transferring funds. While it is difficult to ascertain how much funding comes from the Gulf and Saudi sympathizers, it seems more than probable that a significant level continues. An online poll in July 2014 revealed that 92% of Saudi citizens interviewed believed that ISIS conformed to values of Islam and Islamic law. The group's main source of revenue, however, has been oil. Although ISIS lost two of the Iraqi oil fields it controlled after the Iraqi government security forces reconquered Tikrit in April 2015, it remains a wealthy organization at the time of writing, with numerous legal and illegal revenue streams that involve both local and global partners. The budget is managed by an economic council that produces annual reports each March. The reports describe in detail attacks and military operations, along with revenue and expenditures. In January 2015, overall receipts were reported to be in the region of $2 billion in all the territories controlled by ISIS, with a surplus of $250 million added to the war chest. Ironically, ISIS benefited from the ban on Syrian oil exports imposed by the US and European Union, by selling oil directly to the Assad regime, adding to the suspicion that Assad has been an active collaborator with ISIS, with the intention of eliminating any vestiges of the moderate Syrian opposition that retains some Western support. The suspicion of de facto collaboration gained ground in October 2015 when Assad's Russian allies appeared to give priority to attacking areas controlled by ISIS's rival, Jabhat al-Nusra, over assets belonging to ISIS. The damage caused by US airstrikes to the Syrian oil fields in the Deir el-Zor region had been compensated by ISIS's conquest of Palmyra, Tadmor, which has two fields of natural gas and a phosphate mine, the largest in Syria. Other sources of income include bank robberies, kidnap ransoms, fees exacted at roadblocks, and taxes imposed on traders living in ISIS-controlled areas. Atwan sees management of these funds as indicative of a large, well-organized state-like entity governed in strict accordance with Islamic law. Jizya, the per capita tax paid by Jews and Christians prior to 19th-century Ottoman reforms, is now exacted from non-Muslims, while booty and spoils of war, including captured women and slaves, may be distributed in accordance with Quranic prescriptions. Included in these spoils are the antiquities of ancient archaeological sites, such as Palmyra. In general, the sites are destroyed only after everything of value that can be transported has been removed. In addition to Palmyra, the first site in Syria captured directly from government forces, looters in Syria have been at work on Hellenic and Byzantine remains in Apamaya, Dura Europus, and the ISIS-controlled city of Raqqa. The rise of ISIS owes much to Western policies, including the invasion and disintegration of Iraq from 2003, and the ill-considered decision by Paul Bremer, the American official in charge of Iraq following the US invasion, to disband the Iraqi army and Ba'ath Party, the only national entities capable of keeping the country together. It now seems that, somewhat late in the day, Americans and Russians are inching towards an unacknowledged de facto intervention aimed at limiting the caliphate's territorial spread in Syria. But the US persists in viewing ISIS as a terrorist insurgency rather than a proto-state, As The Economist observed in October 2015, President Obama accepted that it would take time to eradicate the cancer of IS. But he was wrong about much else, in particular his assertion that IS is a terrorist organization, pure and simple. That IS is spectacularly brutal is not in doubt, but it also holds territory, administers it, and is prepared to defend it. About 10 million people live in the area IS controls, the vast majority of them in the relatively populous towns of the Sunni-majority parts of Iraq. Although IS rules by fear, it also attempts to provide basic administration and rudimentary services, which some may find preferable to the malign neglect of the previous Shia-dominated government in Baghdad. It is possible that in its current incarnation, ISIS will be destroyed, in tandem with a diplomatic resolution of the Syrian civil war. This does not mean, however, that the idea of a restored caliphate will die. Support for ISIS has been expressed, in the form of declarations of allegiance to Baghdadi, from places as far removed from each other as northern Nigeria, Libya, Yemen, and Afghanistan. As Burke puts it, "Extremists I have interviewed over the last two decades, in safe houses in Algeria and compounds in Pakistan's Khyber Pass, in madrasas in Bangladeshi slums and kebab shops in East London, in the island capital of the Maldives, and in Gaza City during the War of 2014, all use this same vocabulary. Whether in Arabic, Urdu, Dewehi, Bangla, English, or Pashto, they voice the same set of imprecations and invocations, which together constitute the international lingua franca of Islamic extremism. If a shared language is the defining characteristic of a community, then there can be no doubt that this particular global community exists. A revived caliphate that will preside over this community is integral to the eschatological hopes that are surfacing at this time. A response, no doubt, to the collapse of social structures which accompanies the physical destruction and human casualties afflicting the Islamic heartlands of the Middle East and Yemen. End-time scenarios featuring the town of Dabiq in northwest Syria are especially prevalent and appear in many of the blogs, or what might be called the sales pitches, of ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra. As in Christianity and Judaism, these scenarios have strong pedigrees in classical Islamic thought. Like Christianity, Islam seems to have begun as a messianic movement, warning that the day of judgment was imminent. The early surahs, chapters of the Quran, are filled with doomsday menace, and the yearning for a final reckoning is deeply encoded in other classical texts. A central figure in this tradition is Dajjal, the one-eyed false messiah who corresponds to the Antichrist of the Book of Revelation. The details vary, but most versions agree that the final battle will take place east of Damascus, when Jesus will return as Messiah, kill the pigs, destroy Dajjal, and break the cross in his symbolic embrace of Islam. A hadith in the collection of Ibn Kathir, an influential scholar who lived in Syria and died in 1373, describes some other signs that instantly call to mind the contemporary Sunni-Shia divide and the burgeoning towers now dominating the skylines of Doha, Dubai, and other Arabian cities, including Mecca itself. "The hour will not come till the following events have come to pass. People will compete with one another in constructing high buildings. Two big groups will fight one another. There will be many casualties. They will both be following the same religious teaching. Earthquakes will increase, time will pass quickly, afflictions and killing will increase." The warnings conveyed in these texts can, of course, be dismissed as the product of overheated minds, rather as Bernard Shaw saw the Book of Revelation as the curious record of the visions of a drug addict. But it would be wrong to dismiss ISIS and its propaganda too glibly as the fulminations of terrorists beyond the pale of the Islamic Ummah, or as the heretical writings of Khawarij, as Prince Turki chooses to call them. Turki's grandfather, King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, rode to power on the back of the Wahhabi Ikhwan movement in the 1920s. Contemporary accounts refer to the brutality of the movement in similar terms to those applied to ISIS today. When the Ikhwan became too powerful, he defeated them at the Battle of Sabilla in 1929. Half a century afterwards, his successors faced a major crisis when rebels seized the Grand Mosque of Mecca. It took at least 2 weeks for French special forces to destroy the rebels and restore order. In mounting its challenge to the Saudi monarch's quasi-caliphal claim to lead the Muslim world as guardian of the two holy shrines, ISIS highlights the royal family's love of luxury and acceptance of corruption, which, it claims, renders its members ideologically and morally unfit for the task. The values and hubris of the Saudi dynasty are exemplified by the astounding developments, not to say desecration, of Mecca's holy city, where the world's largest hotel, 70 restaurants and 10,000 bedrooms, is under construction in the dynasty's favorite wedding cake style, with 5 of its 45 floors reserved for exclusive use by the royal family. The Saudi royals and their cronies are compensating for the collapse in oil prices by building high-rise towers surrounding the Kaaba in Mecca so they can benefit from the vast rents that can be charged to the wealthier Muslims arriving from the Gulf. The horrific developments now dwarfing Islam's holiest shrine, with cranes that collapse, killing pilgrims, have been widely condemned by archaeologists and conservationists. The latest disaster afflicting the pilgrims, with more than 700 killed in a stampede, can only add to the criticism, especially if one explanation for the disaster, the closure of two lanes for the benefit of visiting princes, turns out to be true. With the Saudi dynasty seen as incompetent as well as greedy, the king's legitimacy as custodian of Islam's two holiest shrines is now under serious question. By appropriating Wahhabism's iconoclastic rhetoric, along with its anti-Shia theology, ISIS challenges the legitimacy of the Saudi rulers as guardians of Islam's holy places far more effectively than any republican movement. As the Middle East conflict unfolds, with Iraq and Syria falling apart and the US caught between conflicting impulses, fighting alongside Iran in Iraq while opposing it in Syria, it may only be a matter of time before the nightmare of ISIS rule in the Hejaz, the Muslim Holy Land, becomes a reality.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.